Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Dave M. from the Port Fishington Group.
My name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 23rd of 2004. And my home group meets on Monday nights at 7:30. It's meeting as we speak. And I have a sponsor. And it's been an honor and a privilege to sponsor men and women in this program. I've got to be honest with you guys. I'm unbelievably nervous. There's some people in this room that I really consider to be close friends. And physically, I'm not feeling too well, but spiritually, I'm really feeling awesome. A little bit of a sore throat and a cold, so bear with me. I told you my sobriety date, and I also want to tell you guys that on April 22nd of 2004, Alcoholics Anonymous was doing awesome. I need to remind myself of that on a daily basis. I also need to tell you guys that while I do sponsor people, I think it's equally important to be sponsored. I've gotten really close to a lot of people since I've been sober, and quite a lot of them aren't here anymore. And I watched them go through that phase of going out to sponsor the world and losing touch with another person in front of them. And I hope and pray to God that never happens to me. And I know if I have another person in front of me, chances are it won't. We meet on Monday nights, 7:30, in Kensington. I'm quite sure there's some people in this room that know about Kensington. Not a nice part of town, but I get to see good things happen all the time down there. People come in the rooms down there. Much like myself, broken shell of a human being, can't make a living, can't do anything in life, and get to watch them come to life, and watch them, you know, grow up all around us, and I almost feel like we're growing up together. And I have that bond with some people in this room that I met years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and we don't get to see each other much, but then when we do get to see each other, it's always something good, good developments in life, and it's an amazing thing. Oddly enough, this past weekend I was in Florida, and I got reminded by one of your home group members at the conference that I was speaking here tonight. I was trying to not remember that. But that's like kind of how this deal works. Here I am, I'm 1,200 miles away from home, and I run into somebody that I know. Actually, this weekend I ran into a lot of people that I know. And I can assure you that almost 6 years ago, people were not saying, please come back to me. They were not having me back a second time. They were saying things like, please, for the love of God, don't ever come back. They were following me around a store with aerosol cans because I was stinking up the store. Stuff like that. As a child, and I always want to start there, you know, sometimes I get caught up in my story. But really, my story is not what makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is the effect that alcohol has on me, you know. I spent a lot of years in and out of AA. I came to AA the first time when I was 15. And I think one of the fundamental flaws that I always made when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was I related alcoholism to the external world. And I would sit and listen to speakers at meetings. And I would think that alcoholism was defined by... Thank you very much. Oh, nice. That's a neat thing. A lot of podiums don't have that. They're all slant and you can't put the drink anywhere. I always define alcoholism by being this external thing. Like, I'm an alcoholic because I lost my job. I'm an alcoholic because I'm homeless. I'm an alcoholic because I went to jail. And every time I would come into AA, I would listen to a talk and I would say, well, I didn't do this, or I didn't do that, or they didn't drink like I did, and therefore I never got sober. I would sit in AA, and as soon as the speaker said something that was out of my experience, I would just shut it off. And I can look back on my childhood and see that that was present in my life before I ever picked up a drink. I have this innate ability, I don't know if anybody else has this, but I can walk into a room full of people, much like tonight, and I can be better than you and worse than you at exactly the same time. That's been my whole life, I've been like that. You know, people say it's an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I actually heard a woman one time refer to it as being an arrogant doormat. Well, that was me my whole life. And I guess I could describe it to you in one story. When I was a kid, I don't know, people say we can make a big all-star team out of all the members of AA. I was good at sports, and I played on a football team. And I was an offensive guard. I don't know about it. Anyone who knows anything about football, they're not very glamorous. They're like the fat guys in the front that do all the dirty work so that the running back can get all the glory. But that was me. And being an alcoholic without a drink yet at 6 years old or seven, I really resented the running backs. And I'd be sitting in practice, and I'm always developing all these plays for these guys, you know. And I just didn't like it. And this one particular practice, it was on a Tuesday, they set this play up. And the play was the quarterback was going to get the ball and he was going to put it on the ground. And I was going to be blocking. I was just going to turn around, pick the ball up, and run around again for a touchdown. It was a really good play. But I, in my head, as soon as they developed it, we practiced it a couple times, my head's telling me, don't ever call it. But that Saturday they called it. And so they called the play, and now I'm a little bit fear. This is like what I've been waiting for my whole life. Wish it would happen. And now it's happened, I'm scared to death. So I get to the line, they call the play, the ball gets hiked, I pick the ball up, I run around the end, and I mean, there was not a person within 30 yards of me. And what do? I trip. And I never forget it, man, getting up off the ground, and like, you know, I lived in a little small town, and parents would take that spell very seriously. And people were like laughing and pointing, and I just remember that scene in my mind's eye of them people pointing at me. And that's the story of my life, you know. Sitting in AA means complaining about not having a job, and then when I get a job, I'm scared to death to go to work. You know what I mean? Sitting around my house thinking like the world's giving me a bad deal and a raw deal, and I can't get nothing right, and the man's keeping me down, and on and on and on. And then when I get presented with something, I don't know how to do it. And that was my whole life. I get on the bus at school, and it just seemed like everybody else knew what they were doing. You know, you hear that stuff a lot in AA. People talk about that rule book that everybody else got that I didn't get. It just seemed like everything came easy for other people, and everything for me was a struggle. Just the social setting of the lunchroom was enough to like cause me a nervous breakdown. Planning all that stuff and how they were going to react to me and what I was going to say to them, and when they responded to me and I would respond with this. And you guys always said something I wasn't expecting, and I didn't have a plan for that, so I would stutter or stammer and say something that didn't make any sense. And when I walked away, then voices would start. And that's just the way it was. And when I was about 8 years old, I know a lot of people probably go down to shore for vacation. I lived down there. I just want to let you know there's nothing going on down there. There's nothing to do. We drank. And I had not yet drank, but I hung around with people, and that's what they did. We went on the docks. It was called Seaview Docks. It was in Linwood, New Jersey. Everybody was on the docks. And I was watching these kids, and they just seemed like they were comfortable. They seemed like they could communicate with each other freely and openly. I couldn't see what was going on inside of me going on inside of anybody else. I know the truth today. The truth today that I know is people all around me have developed these defense mechanisms. I can't see what's going on in their head. I only see what's going on their outside. And I convinced myself that, you know, they weren't going through the same things that I was. And I drank 4 Rolling Rock Pony bottles, and that thing that happens for us happened to me that day. For me, what happened was I was not worried about what you guys were thinking about me anymore. I didn't plan what I was going to say, I just said it. And the cool thing that alcohol did for me was my perception was that you guys really enjoyed what I was saying. And it sounds like a small thing, but that means a lot to a guy like me, because I had such a high value on what you thought about me. So that meant a lot to me. And that was how it started. When I first got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a fan, but he's new. You're always sitting in the meeting like planning out. I remember being like 3 months over, like I can't wait to, I got this whole thing planned out. I'm going to get up there and say all this stuff. And I was always kind of attached to my story. I was always attached to the rest of my story because it's pretty crazy. And what I want to tell you guys is that the rest of my story is not what makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is what happened to me on that dock that day. And there was going to come a time later in my life when alcohol turned on me, just like it says in Bill's story, and cut me to ribbons. But something switched in me that day that wasn't switching back and isn't going to switch back. It just changed. And I had this other interesting problem. I had this desire to be accepted. I had this desire that for you guys to like me and for people to like me in my school. And I was in a school, Mainland Regional High School, and there was like 3 or 4 guys in the school, and I used to notice how people treated them. People would like these guys would walk up the hallway, and it was like the parting of the Red Sea when they walked up the hallway. Like people would just get out of their way. They were very respectful to them. They were like, and I wanted what those guys had to offer. I was very attracted to that. I liked that idea. And I watched what they did. They sold non-AA conference-approved substances at the school. Use your imagination. One thing I missed on that tip was that they were really, really good at it, and I wasn't. One of the things that goes along with that kind of lifestyle is like confrontation. And while I have a desire to get you guys to think I'm a tough guy, I want to tell you the truth right now and like put it right out on the floor. I'm not. I don't like confrontation. I don't like arguments. If I give little Joey something and then I need to get $40 back for him next Friday, I would rather just take the loss than go say something to him. And for that reason, I wasn't very good at what I was trying to do. Nobody got out of the way for me in the hallway. You know what I'm saying? So my plan kind of went south. The other problem was that everything that I was doing was based on ego. I wanted you guys to look at me as that guy. I don't know if anybody remembers 1988 and how the cell phones looked back then. They were rather large and cumbersome. And I looked like I was calling in troop reinforcements to Vietnam whenever I used them. But I used it as often as I could, around as many people as I could, because I wanted you to see me on that phone, because somehow in my sick, delusional mind, that would give me some kind of like value. And because it was all about ego, that's how they ended up. I ended up standing in front of a judge at the age of 15 and got sentenced to juvenile life. And I always bring that up in my story because it's the beginning of a trend in my life. And if there's anybody new in this room, I know you guys are going to understand the trend I'm talking about. And here's how the trend goes for me. I begin a pattern of accepting unacceptable situations into my life. I don't know if anybody is aware of it, but going to jail in my life today is unacceptable. But at that time in my life, it was not even a blip on the radar screen. I didn't even see it as a problem. And that, to me, is another definition of being alcoholic. Like, I couldn't even tell the truth and the false. I had no connection with reality whatsoever, even at that young age. So what it did was it began this trend in my life where things would begin to happen to me. And I would take them in. These really crazy things would happen in my life. And I would internally justify it in my head in some sick way. And then I would act as if it's okay, like it's not a problem. In our big book, it says the abnormal becomes normal. I know exactly what that means, because then that was the beginning of it in my life. I got really good at making those 2 a.m. jail phone calls. You know them ones where you call your family and you don't even know what you're going to say when you're dialing the number. But when my dad would answer the phone, the words would just come from deep within me. And I developed an ability to get that man to do whatever it was I wanted him to do. And I know the truth about my alcoholism today. See, back then, I didn't even see it as a problem. There was a time in my life when I was about 28 years old. My mom had passed away in 1994, and everybody in my family, we got a lot of money. And I went through that money like a train wreck. And then I went through all my father's money, cutting checks and forging his name. And I'll never forget standing in his living room, and he's holding his bank statement in his hand. And he's looking at me right in the eye, and he's going, "Dave, I got $31 in the bank. what happened. And all I could think was how I was going to get 20 of that $31. And I didn't see nothing wrong with it. Couldn't even see what I was doing to this man. The truth is, every time I called him, what I was really doing was ripping his heart right out of his chest. I couldn't see that. So that was the beginning of it. And I went to jail, went to a place in Jersey called Jamesburg. Not a nice place. This was not the spiritual malady, I think. I didn't fit in there. A lot of the kids were there for like a lot of like violent stuff. You know, aggravated assaults, armed robberies, home invasions, and me. I was about 82 pounds, little boondock kid from Jersey, and all these kids were like from Newark and Orange City and Patterson. But again, I think that we as alcoholics are a lot like Marines. We know how to improvise, adapt, and overcome. I was scared to death when I got there, but let me tell you something. About a week into that bid, it was like nothing to me. It's just this the resiliency of the alcoholic. When we get put in these crazy situations, we just have a way to like kind of get through it. You know, and the human spirit is an unbelievable thing. So I spent some time in there, and I was writing letters. I got really good at writing letters, and I kind of made a little job out of it when I was in there, because a lot of the people in there weren't very educated, and I would write their letters to the judge. And I also wrote a lot of letters to my judge, because I'm selfish. And he called me down to his courtroom. His name was Judge Winkelstein. I'll never forget it. And he said, listen, by state law, I can't let you go. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you another chance. You're going to be court stipulated to a treatment center. And I ended up in a program in Philadelphia called The Bridge in Roman Pine. And just before going to that treatment center, I had my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was at a meeting at Life or Death at Tarsdale and Blakeson Streets. There was a kindly old man in that room named Bud the Handyman, Bud R., who has since passed away. Just a side note, it was on my fourth step, my first fourth step. This guy won the lottery twice. Does that piss anybody else off? I spent a lot of money on scratch-offs, and it's, you know, crazy. In any event, I met this man, and he brought me a half a cup of coffee in that meeting. I had been out for a week, and I got released from the jail. I didn't know what to do with myself, and it was just went on a tear. And it was cold, raining, and I was standing outside. And they took me upstairs, and I don't know if it's like a common thing in AA meetings, but like they had the air on like 37 in there. So I'm like cold, and brings me a half a cup of coffee. And I think that's the best description I have of how one alcoholic can best understand and help another one. Because my mother, who probably loves me more than anybody else on this earth, as much as she loves me, I don't think she would have had enough common sense to be able to think, if I bring him a whole cup of coffee, he'll spill it all over himself. But he had enough thought in his head to be able to do that. Can't tell you what was said at the meeting. I wish I could stand up and tell you that it was a spiritual message of rejuvenation and hope. I never drank again and, you know, all that good stuff. But that's not what happened. Matter of fact, all the old-timers laughed at me. Nobody told me there was a pistol range below the meeting, and it was like gunshots going off, and I was like, so my first experience with AA was, you know, comical to say the least. But I went to this treatment center, and I spent about 16 months there. I was like the you know, senior member of the community. I don't know if anybody else does that like I do. I always end up president of the treatment center. I enjoyed it. I really did, and I'll tell you why. Because by the time I left there, I got to be honest with you, this is kind of embarrassing to say, but on my 18th birthday, I didn't want to leave. Because I was somebody in there, man. We had this big dining hall, there was like 40 tables, and we had announcements after dinner. And if little Billy did something wrong during the day, somebody would ask permission from a counselor to stand him up. And after Billy gets stood up and gets told what he did wrong, Billy needs some feedback. And ladies and gentlemen, I just want to let you know, I was the cannon of feedback in the treatment center. They would like, whoever said, you need some feedback, they would look around and look for me. And they would call on me. And I would grind them up. And I enjoyed it. I was somebody. Anytime anything was going on in there, they would come to me. It made me feel good. And I'll be honest with you, on my 18th birthday, I didn't want to leave. And neat little thing happened in there. I think it happens for a lot of us in treatment. I met a girl 2 months before I got out of there. They used to let us go out to get cigarettes up at the corner, and she worked at the gas station. There's nothing like a nice romantic makeout session behind a dumpster. So again, I want to share this with you because this kind of indicates the depth of my selfishness and how little I could really say about what was going on in my life. I had been away since I was 15. The last 6 months of my treatment in this rehab, they were allowing my family to come up on the weekends to visit me. So I got to spend some time with my mom and my dad. And they came up like proud parents do on the day that I graduated, to watch me stand on this chair and play a song and talk to everybody in the treatment center and cry a little bit. You know how we do, like we're all going to stay together forever and ever, and sign each other's books and all that stuff. And I remember getting off that chair, and I'm standing out in the parking lot, and I turned to my mom and my dad, and I said, listen, I'm going to go over Jen's for a couple days. Like, I had no thought in my mind that there's my parents who hadn't had a chance to spend time with me in 3 years. All I could think about was, I'm 18, this chick's got a bedroom, and I'm getting out. Let's go. You know what I'm saying? I couldn't even see the relationship that I had with my parents. And this little thing was starting to happen in my life. When I was a kid, I had a lot of, like, really close family memories. I'm sure a lot of us in this room do. And as life was going on, my family was growing more and more apart and more distant. And I can look back on that, and knowing the truth after taking the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know the truth. The truth is I was the main activator of all that happening in my family. I couldn't see it at the time. I just couldn't see it. So in this treatment center, they got me involved. One of the things they told us was, he said, get involved in an A, pick one. And luckily for me, there was a group right near my house. It's called the Stagecoach Group. They meet in Marmora, New Jersey. They're still there today. It's Butter Road and Route 9 of Marmora, if you're ever on vacation down there. It's a clubhouse. They have meetings all the time. And I loved it there. I'll tell you why I loved it there. It was stone nuts. The other meetings in the area actually refer to that meeting as the Rage Coach. It was the emergency room for Alcoholics Anonymous in that area. And then if you go to another meeting, they'll tell you it's the psych ward of Alcoholics Anonymous in that area. It was the kind of place where, you know that cute little saying we have where they say, you know, if nobody told you they loved you today, let us be the first. Well, there they said, if no one told you they loved you today, come back tomorrow. You know, that's kind of how they go. They believed in one principle, and it was that we don't take the first drink and we can't get drunk. And they would talk about it. They had this whole like group symbol thing. They all did this, you know. And if somebody got them a cup of coffee at the meeting, they would all smell it. And they would say, good batch, you know. They talked a lot about the hideous four horsemen. They talked a lot about alcohol being cunning, baffling, and powerful. Meetings had no time limit. And I think every mental patient in the tri-state area knew that. And they all showed up there and talked about a variety of topics. And there was always drama going on. There was always excitement going on. It was always somebody else's life that I could get involved in to forget how pathetic mine was. And somewhere along the line, I just kind of thought that's what AA was. You know? Somebody, Eric was telling me on my way in that you guys had your business meeting prior to the meeting. And I kind of laughed to myself. I loved business meetings back then. There's nothing better for an untreated alcoholic. I would come to the club at about 5:30. There was a 5:30 meeting. Everybody would come and they got off work. And it was almost like when I look back, it was like everybody getting off work and going to the bar. It was so crazy. And after the meeting, I would just kind of take the pulse, you know, leading up to the business meeting, which was at 7:30. And I would take the pulse of the room, see what was happening, what was the hot button issue, you know, because there's always something going on. Change the coffee, change the seating, go to smoking, whatever. You know, there's always something going on. And then I would formulate the most controversial motion I could come up with. And I would do it at just the right time. I got really good at it. It's a skill. You almost have to, like, cultivate it, develop it. And then I would just sit back and watch the show. And this little smile would form on my face. And I wouldn't even stay at the end of the business meeting. It didn't even matter to me, for real. I like this harmony. I like this unity. I like to see people debate and argue. I mean, the most meaningless stuff. And just craziness. And it was always stuff going on there, you know. And I could get involved in the drama of, you know, Sally slept with Bill, and Bill slept with Sally, and Sally slept with John, and Bill slept with John. You could just get involved in all that stuff. And I went to meetings every single day. I had coffee commitments. I joined a server softball team. I went to dances. Not a good experience if you're untreated like I was. It's nothing like walking home from a dance alone up a street when there's like a couple couples like walking in front of you and you're going back to the recovery house. It's a pretty shitty feeling if you ask me. I did all this stuff. I went to barbecues. I would go to an 8 o'clock meeting, then go to a 10 o'clock meeting, then ended up with a midnight meeting and sit around and drink coffee all night. And I got nowhere. And time was going on. Got a year sober. Got a year and a half sober. Got 2 years sober. My life externally started getting a little better because that's what's going to happen if you're sober. But on the inside, I was a train wreck. And I heard this guy speak in Barnegat, New Jersey. And one of the most unbelievable things I think I've heard since I've been in AA. And he was talking about, you know, we're always in AA and we're always looking for the guy in his first 30 days. And what he said was, what about the guy in his last 30 days? And that was me. And I didn't even know it. I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous, night after night, meeting after meeting, cup of coffee after cup of coffee, asshole speaker after asshole speaker, going out of my mind. I'm judging everybody in the room. And what I'm doing internally is I'm finding all the reasons in the world why I don't have to do what you guys are talking about. See, I don't know if anybody else in this room does this, but I do, and I do it really well. I set standards and expectations on other people that I can't even live up to myself. I don't know if anybody else does that. I do it, and I have a tendency to still do it today, in all honesty. I have an ability to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and point out every flaw that you have. And I'm doing it for one reason and one reason only, so that I have a reason on the inside why I don't have to do what you're talking about. Everybody that would suggest things to me, I had a reason why I didn't have to do it. And the thing I always missed is that while they're suggesting these things to me, whatever's going on in their life, because it is Alcoholics Anonymous, this is not well-adjusted Anonymous, whatever's going on in their life, my life's in the toilet. I'm dying. My life is in the absolute toilet. It's a train wreck. I can't have a relationship with another person if you paid me. But I got a reason why I ain't doing what you're talking about. Because you're cheating on your taxes. You know what I mean? Or you hired that guy for the club. You're not paying his taxes. What if he gets hurt? You know, I got all this stuff going on in my head. And I'm judging myself right out of AA. And I'm doing all the meetings. And externally, my life got good. I had a little business. I was a little hippie kid. I had dreadlocks. I learned how to make tie-dye t-shirts. Doing all that stuff. I'm making a lot of money. Got the girlfriend, which is pretty cool. You know, if you're like me. Then, you know, after I had her for a little while, I thought maybe I'll get another one. You know? So I got the side job. And I just want to, this is for the new guys, if there's any new guys in the room. There's one reason why that side girlfriend is there with you, because there's a little excitement there. You know, it's exciting, sneak around late at night. When the girlfriend finds out about it and she leaves, that other girl's going to leave right after. And just remember I said that. We'll have that conversation down the road a couple years from now. Remember I said that. So I had all this stuff going on. I had a car. I just bought a Volkswagen bus that I was customizing. I had $15,000 in my drawer. I like had to force the money in the drawer to shut it. I had a bank account loaded with money and paid my rent. I lived right on the ocean in Ocean City. I could flick a cigarette in the ocean. I don't know about you, but that's like an old Milwaukee commercial to me. It don't get no better than that. And I was dying. Dying, man. I'm going to these, I call it the untreated alcoholic prayer. And I'm quite sure there's some people that have said this prayer in this room. You go to the meeting, you sit across from that guy, Harry or Bill or John or whatever his name is, and you say, please, God, don't let Harry talk tonight. I don't know if you guys are anything like me. I already know what people are going to say before they say it, because they say the same thing every time they talk. And I'm getting the really, you know, top-notch advice in the meetings. Anybody else? I heard this joke. Somebody said it. Asking for advice in AA is like taking a drink out of a fire hose. People would give me that top-notch advice like, double up on your meetings. Wait a minute. How would I double up? I'm going to like five a day. How the hell are you going to do that? We'll start meetings in my living room, 4 a.m. Living sober. Completely out of my mind. You know, I often think to myself, like, that mentality in AA, and Jack and I have a friend, he's in Philly, he's sober like 23 years, he always talks about his early sobriety. He'd be sitting in a meeting at like 8 o'clock, talking about easy does it, calm down, relax. He's got an easy does it sticker on the back of his car, and he's doing 130, weaving in and out of traffic. That was my experience. There was no recovery in that. I was not drinking, and I was getting mine. That's what my whole life was. And I used to get a rush. My rent was $1,800 a month for that apartment, and I would slam the bills on the table and get a rush out of that. And truth be told, I was not a businessman. I was a kid, and I got taken advantage of. I was basically getting extorted in order to keep my stand open, because the guy knew how much money I was making, and he knew I didn't have the proper licenses. So every month he would jack my rent, and I ended up losing my business. My girlfriend found out about the side girlfriend. She rolled. Like I said, side girlfriend rolled right into that. My mother had passed away. My dog died. All this stuff happened. And right in the same span of time, I stopped coming here. Because I just had it with you people. I kept going to different meetings. You know how you go to one meeting for a certain period of time and you just can't take it anymore, and you're like, I'm going to go over here. And then you go over there for like a month or two, and then you find everything wrong with everybody over there, and then you're like, I'm going to go over here. Well, I had run out of where to go. You know what I'm saying? So the one thing that I had in my life that was supporting me was gone. And I had no God in my life. I had no peace in my life. I didn't have that thing that we need to stand between us and the next drink. And it's my belief today as an active member and a productive member of Alcoholics Anonymous that there will come a time and place, if you are a real alcoholic, where there will be absolutely nothing, not a home group, not a sponsor, not a commitment, not nothing that's going to stand between you and a drink but the power of God. And it took a little bit of a hard knock for me to learn that lesson. So I stopped going to AA, and everything kind of fell apart. My sobriety was external. The results I was getting were all external. And now everything that I was basing my sobriety on was getting taken away from me. So what was I left with? Zero. And I was sitting on the end of my bed, sober 4 years. And this is like a real controversial thing to say, but it's my experience. I treated my alcoholism by not drinking for 4 years, and I was worse than I was when I got here. I was worse. I'm sitting on the end of that bed, and all that stuff is gone, and this thought popped into my head, like, just grab a drink. And the next thought I had right after that said, you better not go out and do that, because you'll lose whatever you got left. And I'm standing here tonight to tell you guys that I knew exactly what was going to happen to me. I played the tape just like them old dudes told me to do at the meeting, and I drank anyway. And when I got back here, a really good member of Alcoholics Anonymous cracked that big book, and he showed me what powerless means, and it's right in that book. And there's a line in that big book that means the world to me today because of my experience, and it says, no matter how great the desire or the necessity for you to stop, you will be absolutely unable to do so. And that was my experience. I knew exactly what was going to happen to me, and I just did it anyway. And the ensuing 9 years of my life was just one feeble attempt at getting sober again after another. In and out of detox, in and out of treatment centers, in and out of jail, back and forth to Florida. And I did all the things in this world I never thought I would do, and I became everything in this world I never thought I would become. And I got to tell you guys that I am not proud of my story, but I think the shame would be not to tell it. When I was a five-year-old kid, I was coming out of a department store with my mom, and it was a van, and I remember looking out the window of this van and seeing that guy. You know that guy that's at the department store, like at an exit. He's got the long hair and the beard and the sign, begging for change. And I remember being a little kid thinking, like, what loser, man. I'm never going to be like that. And that was exactly what I became. My life became that small. And I'm not going to go into the sort of details because I could stand up here until midnight, but I know there's people in this room that know what I'm talking about. There's not words that I can put to describe the loneliness of walking up Kensington Avenue and knowing that no matter where I turn to or where I go, there's not going to be a smiling face wherever I end up. Walking up that street in a rainstorm or a snowstorm, there's no one like, I don't even know where I'm walking to. I'm just walking. And the feeling of like laying in the subway and, you know, it's 6:30 and everybody's doing the hustle bustle work thing. And catching that look out of the corner of my eye when I like look up and see somebody walk stepping over me to go to work. And that look of disgust in their eye when they're walking over me. I don't ever want to forget what that feels like. But that was my experience. That's what happened to me after I picked up a drink. I could not physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, I couldn't stop. I had absolutely no power, no choice, and no control over that first drink. None whatsoever. I had an experience in the Camden County Correctional Center that I think describes my powerlessness to a T. My father, and I'm not a guy that gets visits in jail. And to be honest with you, it's the exact opposite. I have to write my own name on the mail list just to see my name up there, you know, or mail myself a letter. And I always end up with the jerk, you know, them jerk offs in jail that have like three different chicks coming to see them. That's always my selling. That's what I got to deal with. But this one time, my dad came to see me, and we were sitting talking. Remember earlier I was telling you about how tight my family was and how distant we had become. And we were sitting talking, and we were talking about my mom and, you know, this trip we had taken, and we like rode on horses over up a mountain that had steak and eggs over an open fire at sunrise. Like this whole big deal, man. It was awesome. And it was like just at this moment, I had this thing like flash all before my eyes. Like that was my life as a kid and how tight my family was and how connected we were. And then here we are now in front of my bathroom class on a phone. And he started crying and I started crying and I had one of them moments. And I was convinced, man, on that day, man, I'm not doing this no more. I just got a conviction, I'm done, I'm not doing it no more. And I went back, I was going to start a revolution in that jail. I was like standing on a table when I got back. Can't live this way anymore. And I was drunk 5 minutes after I walked out of that jail. This weird thing started happening to me. I started getting all these intentions and ideas every time I go to jail. Like, I'm just going to get back on the horse again. I'm going to try it again. And I would do all the self-help stuff. And I'm chairman of the self-help committee. And they would call me down and set your chairs up for the meetings. And I'm doing all this stuff. And then they would go, Dave, we're going to discharge. And I would walk. It was about 150 feet from the block to the receiving room where I got dressed to go out into the world. And something happened in my head on that walk. All them ideas that I developed when I was in jail would get pushed to the one side and this completely new set of ideas would start to take over. And it would go something like this. That'll be different this time. You'll feel one. It'll be all right. It'll be different. That kind of thing. And always ended up going back. So on April 23rd of 2004, I'd love to give you a dramatic, you know, blaze of glory, shootout with the cops, you know, and crazy stories we hear in here. Mine's really not like that. It's kind of humiliating. I fancy myself a criminal mind. I got locked up by a park ranger. Glad you find it funny. I was sitting on a bench at Roosevelt Boulevard and Southampton Road, enjoying a half a cigarette that I had stolen out of Northeastern Hospital's ashtray the day before. And this guy pulled up in a dune buggy. And I didn't even have like one of the Smokey the Bear patches. That's embarrassing. And he asked me my name. And I gave him a fake name, because that's what we do. And he went back to his little dune buggy, in which he had some supercomputer, because he figured everything out. Because, you know, I'm such a mastermind, he shouldn't be able to figure that out, right? And he said, put your hands behind your back. And I can be absolutely candid with you guys tonight. There's no way that if one of you guys would have been in that car and would have told me what was about to happen to me or what has happened to me from that day till this one, I would have asked you for a shot of whatever it was you were drinking, because that ain't happening to me. If there's anybody in this room who's been in and out of AA a lot, let me tell you something. I know what it feels like. One of the worst things that happens to us when we do that kind of stuff is we develop ideas and we get these belief systems and we have all this stuff going on in our heads. And we defeat ourselves sitting right here in AA. We convince ourselves that everybody else is judging us. And we convince ourselves that they're talking about us and they really don't like us. And we bring with us the same tired old ideas that we had with us the last time we were here that obviously didn't work, otherwise we wouldn't be bringing them back with us again. I was convinced one of the ideas I had that AA was for you people and it wasn't for me. I was just convinced of it. I tried this, man. I would come to the meetings, I would sit in the meetings, I'm too good for a month, get a little money in my pocket, get a new girlfriend, get a little chirp phone. And then this voice, man, this voice that would never, it would never leave me alone. It would just pop up in the back of my head with like a month and a half sober. What are you doing? This isn't going to work for you. You're a loser. Then I would get up and walk out. Well, I believe in my heart that on that day, April 23rd of 2000, and I can assure you, I got up that morning, I was not planning on getting sober that day. If my sobriety date had anything to do with me, I would not be speaking tonight. I can assure you of that. 10 seconds before that guy pulled up to ask me my name, getting sober was not even on my list of things to do that day. And furthermore, I didn't really have a list of things to do that day. Did the same things every day. I ended up in jail and had an experience. I believe it was the hand of God that just cut this thing out of me. I feel like I've been blessed because I haven't really struggled. It happened to me. I heard a voice. I was in a cell. It was like I was in a cell with another person and I was all alone. And the voice said, the fight is over. And I didn't know what that was. But I knew that jail sentence, it was about 2.5 months that I was in jail. It was just a little bit different. It wasn't like any other jail sentence I had done. And I ended up getting released to a Spanish recovery house. In case anybody notices, I'm not Spanish. We were laughing about it on the way up. This is how selfish and self-centered I am. I used to be convinced. I would walk into a room and it was all these Spanish guys and they're talking in Spanish. Talking about me. No, not a shadow of that. And on a Wednesday night, it was the 7 o'clock meeting. It was on the other side of the city. And I ended up sitting in Cahawks Playground on a Wednesday night in a meeting called It's in the Book. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I had never heard it discussed before. And I want to give this a little clarifier, because I believe in my heart that this message has been being carried since 1935. Problem for me was I didn't hear it. And there's a reason why I didn't hear it, because of what I was doing. I wasn't in the front row. I was usually in the back talking to Susie Cream Cheese, a new girl. I was not interested in what you guys were talking about. I got a really good friend in my life who talks about it all the time, that we have eyes and we can't see and we got ears and we can't hear. I know exactly what he's talking about. I don't want to be that arrogant and get up at this podium and say that like I had never heard this before that night, because I'm firmly confident in my belief that there's people carrying this message. I just wasn't ready to hear it. I heard a guy say one time that you're not going to hear what we have to say until you're ready to hear what we have to say. And it's like one of them real simple old-timer things that, like, you're just like, huh? And then later on, you know exactly what he's talking about. And when I remember when that guy said that, I was like, I don't even know what that means. Old guys got some funny stuff they say in here. So I ended up in this meeting, and I met this man who turned out to be my sponsor. And he had me take these actions. And I got to be honest with you guys, I was not like really feeling it. I was really kind of disgusted with myself. I had a lot of guilt. I carried that around with me like a cross. I just knew. I'm like, I'm 30 years old. I got nothing. I got nothing to show for my life. I got no job skills, no job history other than fundraising. I got nothing going on. And I'm going to these meetings and I'm seeing these people and they're happy and they're shiny and they're bright and they got stuff happening and things are happening in their lives and they're getting girlfriends and families and responsibilities. And I'm like looking at it. It was the same experience as I had when I was a kid. Like, how are they doing that? You know, I don't know how that's going to be. That's not me, you know. And I just sort of found this guy around and doing what he told me to do. And it's crazy, but like, it's really, really, really that simple. My experience in recovery has been all over the place, you know. I've had experience with ego-inspired sponsorship. I was that guy that I talked about at the beginning of the talk. I sponsored like everybody that was living at the last stop at one time. And I would like totally not even remember who I was talking to. I'd be sitting with them in the basement like, oh, you ready to do your fifth step? And the dude's looking at me like, I got my amends list here, you know. And I was wondering like it was a 12-step factory. I don't know if anybody has any experience with that. You sit down with somebody, you're like, you got the spiel down. You know what I mean? 1, 2, 3, say this, read this, read this, read this. You got that, hold the soul spirituality. Good, 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 good. Smack him on the ass, see you next week. You know, there was like no connection. And I know from my experience with one-on-one work with another alcoholic, when you're in that moment and you're in that zone when God is present, it's like sitting in a car and you're passing a heart back and forth. I know what that feels like. And I know when it's happening, and I also know when it's not. And that sort of happened to me sober. You know, you get these experiences, and you get to, people ask you to go and do things, and thank God for the fellowship. God has blessed me with a lot of really good people that know how to, like, keep me in my place, you know. I have a wife in my life who has the ability to remind me how goofy it is for me on a daily basis. And you need that, you know. When I was a kid, my father had these, he was a Christian brother. He was orphaned as a child. He was raised by Christian brothers. And when he left, it was time for him to leave the orphanage. He was like scared of death. He was 18. He had been there his whole life. He was like, I'm just going to stay. And he became a Christian brother. So as a result of that, I have like 150 uncles. And this one guy, Brother Marcel, I became really close with. And he didn't suffer from alcoholism, but he had some other problems. And we kind of connected on that level. And he used to write me letters when I was in and out of jail. And I always save this one letter. It was the 9 Beatitudes of the Wise Person. It was this little pamphlet he sent me. And one of the pamphlets, right at the very end, it said, blessed is he that laughs at himself, for he has never done being amused. And in AA, we say it a little bit differently. In AA, we have this thing called rule number 62, which is don't take yourself too damn seriously. God's blessed me with some old-timers that taught me a very valuable lesson. You don't ever want to become so spiritual that you're no earthly good. Your mind should always be in the clouds with God, but your feet should always be firmly planted, you know? And I'm living in Kensington, so there's a lot going on down there, you know? We have the privilege and the pleasure of getting to work with a lot of people. And in this time, in the last like 5 years and 9 months, I've met people from all up and down the East Coast. And pretty much know in my heart that I can go pretty much any city on the East Coast and know that I'm going to be okay and I'm going to have a place to stay. That's a pretty cool deal for a guy like me. I got here, man, I could not function as a human being. I didn't know how to have relationships with people. I didn't know how to communicate with people. I didn't know how to be nice to people. I didn't know any of that stuff. Because of this guy, and I don't believe that my experience in recovery, I think it started with that guy, you know. And he had no idea that night at Cahot's Playground when we were standing outside smoking a cigarette, when I walked up to him like this with my hands in my pockets and was like stuttering and stammering, going, Chris, I was kind of, you know. He knew to take the weight off me. He didn't put me down. He was like, Dave, I'll talk to you later in the car. He didn't say some smart-ass comment to me. Later on in our relationship, it was like the guy knew, he always knew exactly what I needed it when I needed it. And I didn't have to say anything to him or indicate it to him, he just did it. And some days I'd be all piss and vinegar coming into the meeting all crazy, and he would kind of chop me down a little bit. And then other days I would come into the meeting and I'd be feeling a little down. And he would say, hey, that new guy was asking about you earlier. Why don't you go talk to him? So like, it was like this guy knew what I needed when I needed it. And I'm going to talk a little bit about living in current in my life. There's a lot of times, I think we get up here sometimes, and we do a disservice because we don't... I don't want to ever present this message to someone like, you're going to go through the 12 steps, your life's going to be great, and that's going to be the end of it. Goodbye. Okay. Because that's not been my experience. Like I told you guys, I didn't have nothing when I got here. I had no job skills. I had no job history. I had nothing. And I got this idea, and much like most of us do, when you get an idea in your head, you want to talk about it for a while before you actually do it. I call it being in the thinking stage. And I remember this old guy at the last stop one day. I was talking about going to college, we're going to go to college. And he was like, why don't you just shut up and do it? And I did all the stuff. I went to the library. My friend Tom helped me enroll and did all that stuff. And I remember getting on the bus, and I got down to 17th and Spring Garden, and I get off, and I got like a 2-block walk up to where the college campus is. Scared to death. Scared to death. I'm looking around at everybody, and I'm like, I'm about 6 months out of jail, maybe 5 months. I still got Chuck Taylor's on that I bought at the county. I still make that Sunday afternoon trip with my orange laundry bag up to the laundromat. And I'm looking at all these people, and they're bright, and they're shiny, and they got all the big hoop earrings, which amaze me. I think they're pretty cool. Bright clothes, shoes, everything's new and bright and shiny, and they're all laughing and smiling. I don't belong there. I'm not going to fit in there. And my head's chewing me up. It's grinding me up. And it was like walking the gauntlet. If anybody ever seen that Clint Eastwood movie, that's how I felt. And I got to the door of the school, and I got all this stuff going on in my head. And his little voice was like, why don't you just go back down the last stop and grab a new guy to work with? Now, here's how this could go. Because this is how tricky walking with God is and how important it is to rely on God. Because here's what could have happened. I could have listened to my head. I could have gotten on the bus. I could have drove back to the last stop. I could have grabbed a new guy and been out in the yard with him. And one of you guys might have driven by the last stop and looked in the yard and said, look at Dave. What a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. Really? I was hiding, living in fear, using this stuff to like avoid the responsibilities of my life. And thank God for good sponsorship. I had a sponsor whose voice went, I don't know if anybody has a sponsor, if you hear their voice in your head. It's a good sponsor if you got that. I heard this guy's voice, and his voice was saying the fear prayer over and over in my head. Ask God to remove that fear and direct your attention to what He would have you be. And he always used to follow it up with a really important piece of direction for a guy like me. And don't forget, after you say that prayer, to hold your head up high and go about your business like a man. And he showed me that quote in the book where it says, as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. And I did that. And I ended up winning like a new mouse pad for my computer, 5 t-shirts, coffee cups, because it was like some quiz about orientating yourself to the school. And that was like the beginning of me learning how to walk through fear. See, Alcoholics Anonymous is not, it's not only lived in this room, it's lived out in the world. And that's where it's really hard. Now, some days I wish, to be totally honest with you guys, I wish that life was just one big AA meeting. Because I do AA pretty damn good. But I need a lot of help with life. But if you search around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll find those people. And I know for a fact, from knowing them up at this group, there's a lot of them here that can show you how to apply these principles in your life. And when you start doing that, all of a sudden you'll look around and have this wonderful life set out before you. I never had a partnership with another human being like the one I got with my wife. And I spent the weekend in Florida. I promised her I would tell the story. I was so sick. I've been sick for like 2 weeks. And I came home. She's Jewish. And a lot of you guys know her. She made this awesome matzo ball soup. She says it's Jewish penicillin. Like, I'm sitting on the couch last night. That blew my mind, because that don't happen to me. Like I said, sweetie, I'm not feeling well, when I called her Sunday morning. She did that on my way home. And I could do the same thing with her. I have the ability to do that. That is a cool deal for me. That's probably the biggest gift I got here. And you would have never convinced me of that sitting in the back of that cop car. So if you're new, grab somebody in this room who's got a little light in their eye, a little spring in their step. And if there's people talking about them, grab them. My experience has been the guys that are doing this are usually not very well liked by some of the other people around. And all you got to do is just do what they say. It's really not that complicated. I heard a woman say, and it's probably the best thing I can say, it'll probably sum up everything that I just said for the last hour. It's pretty simple. Monkey see, monkey do. So I want to thank you guys so much for having me, and God bless you.